Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the dialogue with Dewa De Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. You can text us your thoughts on 2057 and email your questions to inbox@realitycheck.radio. We are joined now by Otto Pohl. He was a university at the American University of Central Asia, the University of Ghana, and also at the American University of Iraq. He currently resides in New Mexico in the United States. His research focus has been on the sufferings of a number of ethnic minorities under the Soviet Union, such as the Germans, the Kurds, Crimean Tatars, and many others. He's published dozens of papers and written a number of books focused on the USSR. Welcome to the show, Otto.
Thank you.
Could you give us a little bit of an overview on your latest book and why the subject of it is so interesting to you personally?
Okay, so my latest book, The Years of Great Silence, the English translation of the German term, Die Jahre des großen Schweigens, which was used to describe a period of time under Soviet rule when they were forcibly uprooted and sent to eastward into Siberia and Kazakhstan and placed under legal restrictions known as the special settlement regime. So this lasted from 1941 until the end of 1955. And this book basically kind of an accumulation of collection of archives from Moscow and some other places, Estonia, Kyrgyzstan, United States, and some oral interviews with elderly ethnic Germans in Kyrgyzstan. And of course, a wide variety of secondary sources, although many of the published sources are kind of like 1.5 rather than secondary sources in that they're verbatim reproductions of archival documents. So a lot of the published material on the subject, particularly out of the Russian Federation, but also places like Kazakhstan, consist of these document collections that started being published in the 1990s. There's less now because the archives are far more restricted than they were not too long ago. But there was a period of time in the early 90s when there was almost free access to some of the archives in the Russian Federation, but no real systematic plan. So it basically, if anything you could gather, you could publish. And that was part of the declassification of historical material on the Stalin era.
And this happened during, I guess, the fall of the Soviet Union.
This was afterwards, in the early 90s. And then there is greater restrictions. But it's still, particularly Moscow, pretty open until the recent intervention by the Russians into Ukraine. Other places that are openly democratic, like Kyrgyzstan, have much more closed archives. When I went there, basically anything that had been classified during the Stalin regime was reclassified under the pro-US, pro-democratic government, which I find somewhat ironic, but thinking about reality, not really surprising.
Yeah, that's maybe a little bit strange. So the information wasn't available, as you mentioned, under the USSR, because it was illegal to basically talk about what had happened with deportations and special settlements that you've mentioned. And the title of your book, I'll just repeat it again for the audience, The Years of Great Silence, The Deportation, Special Settlement, and Mobilization into the Labor Army of Ethnic Germans in the USSR from 1941 to 1955. And I had a little look around in New Zealand. I don't think it's easy to get except from maybe on Amazon. So if you're interested in the book, have a little look around online and see if you can get a copy, or you could ask your library even. I don't know if they would order in a copy, but you can always ask your local libraries to get copies of books.
If you are in the United States or Canada, the official distributor is Columbia University Press, because the publisher is in Germany. If you are in the European Union, then you can go directly to Ibidim Verlag, the publisher in Stuttgart. and get it shipped within the EU. It becomes more problematic for places like the UK that are in neither North America or the European Union.
And now, why did this subject interest you personally? Have you got a bit of a background with some of the people who were affected by these deportations and ethnic cleansings?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of a gradual process, but my own heritage on the Pole side, for ethnic Germans from Congress Poland and Volhynia in Ukraine. And my great-grandfather came to Canada after avoiding mobilization in the reserves to fight against Japan in the Russo-Japanese War. So my grandfather was born in Winnipeg, and his first language was German. But also, there are two letters from cousins of my great-grandfather from 1945 in Berlin, written in the old German, because they had been in Poland, or at least the Russian ruled Poland, since 1815. They had been moving west, eastward from Poznan for a while. But two of my great-grandfather's cousins asking for help to come to America. And he put up a $50,000 bond for one of them, who managed to make it over to the U.S. The other one was forcibly repatriated back to the Soviet Union by the Allies. There's a whole chapter in the book about the forced repatriation of 200,000 ethnic Germans back to the USSR by the American and British forces in Germany. And we have no idea what happened to him. I really haven't looked into it. But what I know generally about the policy, it probably was not a very good fate.
Sorry to hear that. So for the history that people would be maybe more familiar with, you know, what caused this and or what during the time that it happened, when Germany lost World War II, I guess there was quite a shrinking of German territory that involved the displacement of many Germans from their homes, especially in Eastern Europe. If that's correct, the Lebensraum of German expansion was undone. They tried to sort of push ethnic Germans back into Germany. An obvious example I can think of that relates to current politics a little bit might be Kaliningrad, which is sort of a Russian colony in Europe that's a bit disconnected from Russia, which has got a bit more attention now due to the Ukraine war. But this little bit of Russia is wedged in between the Baltic states and Poland in a large part because they deported the previous German population and replaced them with ethnic Russians. Is that all of this sort of tied into what your book covers? And was it due to the end of the Second World War?
My book only mentions that, kind of put it in a broader context of the population displacement, particularly of ethnic Germans in Europe during the 1940s. But the main focus is on the ethnic Germans that were in the Soviet Union, were Soviet citizens, were descended of German colonists that had come between 1764 and 1871 or so, with the unification of Germany completely cutting off new German colonists into the Russian Empire. So they were all deported early on in the war. In 1941, the European areas of the Soviet Union still under control of the Soviet government in Moscow. The NKVD basically ethnically cleansed all of the Germans west of the Urals Mountains into Siberia and northern Kazakhstan. So the first wholesale movement is from the Volga region, almost 450,000 or so deported, mostly into western Siberia, about 75,000 in the Krasnoyarsk in eastern Siberia, and 100,000 into the northern Kazakhstan. There had been earlier deportation of the Germans from Crimea, but they only moved them initially to the northern Caucasus, the Orjanakidze Krai, which is now Stavropol, in August 15th, 1941. And after the harvest, for which they used for labor, is bought in October, they're deported with the ethnic Germans already living in that region into Kazakhstan. But basically, the region of European USSR, including Georgia, eastern Ukraine, Western Ukraine came under German rule pretty fast in 1941. Azerbaijan, these areas are all ethnically cleansed of the German population between September and December 1941.
And interesting then to hear that the deportations, normally when I think of deportations, I'm thinking people are being sent back to where they came from. But in this case, they were sent in the other direction. The Germans, for the most part, relocated far towards the east into kind of more hostile conditions, no farmland, colder, frozen wastelands.
Yeah, the term deportatia makes it big into the Russian scholarship in the late 80s and early 90s with one of the premier collators of these document collections. He also writes some monographs, Nikolai Bugay, who was at the Russian Academy of Sciences. So he used the term, and he uses it going back to the Latin, to remove from your area of settlement, right? So they're being removed from their area of settlement. In some cases, they're being removed from their official homeland, the Volga German Autonomous Soviet Social Republic. So there's these pseudo states for various ethno-national groups in the Soviet Union. And this is kind of where you get it, because they're being removed from the official territory that they've been given by the Soviet government. This happens with other groups later on, Karachais and Kalmyks in 43, the Chechens, the English, Balkars, Crimean Tatars in 1944. These all had territories that had some official recognition. Although in the case of the Crimean Tatars, the territory was just the Crimean Autonomous Soviet Social Republic. They didn't put the word Tatar in it. But there was other legislation, such as recognition of Crimean Tatars and official language, that made it functionally similar to places like the Volga German ASSR.
So Germans had been living there for a few hundred years, I guess, even prior to the breakout of World War One, and the Russian Empire fought with the German Empire in World War One. Were there no similar arguments made, I guess, for deportations? They would be subverting the Russian cause.
The German settlement started in 1764, so there's about 250 years now since the first settlement, although there's almost no Germans left in the Volga. There's a few people that managed to return, but for the most part, the 400,000 remaining ethnic Germans in the Russian Federation mostly live in Western Siberia, where they were deported to in 41, and there's about 200,000 still left in northern Kazakhstan. But no, World War One, there were deportations. The Volhynian Germans, the Germans in Poland, the Germans in some of the other western areas of the Russian Empire, a total about almost 200,000, had their land confiscated or their leases terminated and were forcibly deported either to the Volga or to Siberia in 1916. So there is the earlier Tsarist deportation of Germans. It affected my great-grandmother's family, who were forcibly deported out of Volhynia during World War One eastward. But it didn't reach total deportation because of the February 1917 revolution. So the plan was in March 1917 that the Tsarist government was going to round up the Volga Germans and send them into Siberia. But they were unable to because they were thrown out of power, and Kerensky becomes the leader under the provisional government between February and November 1917.
And then which side did these German groups end up in during the Bolshevik Revolution, the Civil War, as well with the Russian whites, the remnants of those loyal to the Russian Empire against the Red Army? You mentioned, I guess, the ethnic Germans had a socialist republic and so on. Was there a push towards communist revolution among the Germans then?
There's two groups of Germans. So there are the Russian Germans, the descendant of the colonists that come under Catherine II in response to the 22nd July 1763 manifesto. And then Mennonites get a charter of privileges under her son, Paul I, in 1800, and start coming. And in 1804, her grandson, Alexander I, has another manifesto inviting Germans into the Black Sea region, as opposed to the Volga, like his grandmother. There's also the much older, going back to the Middle Ages, German population in Estonia and Latvia, Estland, Livland, and Courland, under the Tsarist government. And these Germans, there were about 75,000 of them when they were evacuated into Germany in 1940, are very different socially. So these are nobles, many of them serving in the Russian military and in high ranks. General Kaufmann, who conquered Tashkent, was a Baltic German. There were a number of Baltic Germans, such as General Pietro Wrangel and Ungern von Sternberg, who fight with the whites. But these are socially very different than the Germans who were farmers in the Volga and Ukraine and Caucasus. So for the Russian Germans proper, they tried to take their own side and organize for German autonomy within the fluctuating new state that came about. Now, Lenin creates the Volga German Workers Autonomous Commune in October 1918, and this is the first national territory in what will become the Soviet Union in the end of 1922, with the first Soviet constitution and the union between Russian Federation, Soviet Federated Socialist Republic, Ukraine, and Transcaucasia, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. But they didn't manage to get autonomy in their own kind of accord. So it only was through the Soviet Leninist version. And if you look at the initial leadership, and even going on, the initial leadership of the Volga German Autonomous Workers' Commune were mostly German and Austrian prisoners of war. They were not Volga Germans. They were Germans that had come from Germany or Austria. And so those areas obviously had a much greater socialist movement than the very agrarian and religious and in many ways conservative Volga German and Black Sea German populations.
You mentioned in the list of generals, General Pietro Wrangel. I've got a book that I've read of his memoirs, Always With Honor, which is fairly easy to get because it's been republished recently. So if anyone is listening and is interested in that particular part of World War One, post-World War One, with the Bolshevik Revolution and the story of the Russian whites, would be just something I would recommend looking into Pietro Wrangel as well. Now, how did things go in moving on to back to World War II? How did a lot of these people integrate? Like, were they very much integrated, assimilated into the Soviet Union, into the Russian society, or were they still very ethnically distinct? And is that what caused them to be singled out?
The way the Soviet Union is set up, of course, you have official recognition and support for local cultures through these national territories. So they maintained German language and other elements of culture, but the Soviet Union was trying to guide it into a Soviet form, as the so-called national in form and socialist in content. And this was true with every group. So you see it with large indigenous groups like the Uzbeks and Ukrainian. You see it with smaller indigenous groups like the Kalmucks and various North Caucasian people such as the Chechens. You see it among other diaspora groups such as the Koreans in the Far East. So this wasn't unique, but the Soviet government began to become very suspicious of diasporas that have political states connected to their culture abroad, particularly those that are hostile. So we see already in 1935 and 1936, there are deportations of ethnic Germans away from the borderlands, particularly from Western Ukraine, the border of Poland, into Kazakhstan. We see in 37 and 38, there's a number of national operations aimed at rooting out spies among diaspora populations. There's a German operation. There's about 29,000 Germans executed in 9,000 sent to labor camps. There's an additional number also accused of being kulaks and persecuted on that basis as well, because the Germans historically, particularly in the Black Sea region where they practiced private agriculture rather than a communal mir system, were quite wealthy. So the one thing that happens in the Civil War is there's a lot of plundering and theft of German villages, particularly by the Bolsheviks in the Volga region. And in eastern Ukraine, the Mennonites are hit very hard by the anarchists under Nestor Makhno.
And so this was during the time when they were allied still with the Nazi Germany, when this started. And a lot of the suspicion that you're mentioning, even some of the deportations, this wasn't actually when they were openly at war with Germany during this stage of World War II.
It slides from moving from a class basis to an ethnic basis, but you start to see the accusation that all Germans are kulaks starting in 1930 and 1931 on the ground level with the actual OGPU, which will become the NKVD, in their deportation. This is noted in the document, the use of chauvinistic and slogans against the Germans being dekulaki. And then, of course, there's the deportations from the borderlands, specifically naming, you know, Germans. There's also Polish population deported at that time in 1936. And then in 37, 38, the national operations are obviously targeting. The largest one is against the Polish population. The second largest is against the German population. And then there's kind of a lull. So when the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is signed on August 23rd, 1939, up until after the German invasion, 22nd June 1941, there isn't much going on as far as persecution of Germans. They kind of like put it on the back burner because of foreign relations. And it's only actually in July, so after the invasion, you start then to see the revamping up of the persecution of ethnic Germans and Soviet Union, starting with the removal of numbers of them from the Soviet Red Army and sending them to forced labor detachments. And this will become total for the ethnic Germans in the Soviet Red Army in September, 8th of September, 1941. So that's actually after the deportation from the Volga of the civilian population to Siberia and Kazakhstan begin. But there was already movement to remove a number of them in July of 1941.
I've always thought of like the communist regime, the Soviets, they portray themselves as internationalists and everyone being the same. It's kind of almost a little bit surprising to hear that they were actually very ethnically focused and ethnically discriminatory to the point of ethnic cleansing within the Soviet Union. I guess, does that really go against the impression that a lot of people have of communism, of Soviet Russia at the time, that they were engaging? Is it just that it's been covered up really well, or that people expect?
No, it's always there. Even in the writings of Marx, he talks about, you know, nations that are not suited for continued survival into the socialist era, and therefore will have to disappear, right? But once you got into the practice of socialism under Lenin and particularly Stalin, it became quite apparent that the Soviet version of state socialism, that there were a number of national groups that were not going to be able to be molded in their current form. So one of the things that you see is this during the Second World War, but really starting in 37 with the Koreans, right, this dispersal of these groups away from their traditional areas of settlement and destroying their compact areas of settlement as a way to kind of destroy them as collective organisms, because it was feared that any nation that developed outside of the borders of the Soviet Union, that is outside the Russian Empire, was still politically connected to their foreign homeland. And so this occurred even with the Koreans, who were under Japanese colonial rule at the time, that these people, because their ethnicity and culture has origins outside of what is the area that has been controlled by the Soviet Union, that they couldn't be trusted and were therefore hostile enemy nations allied with the hostile states that shared their ethnicity.
This may be speculating a little bit outside the subject matter, but made me think that the current version of communism, the progressive movement, in being sort of seemingly hostile to Europeans, sort of an anti-white ideology, is that still part of communism today then, basically, the idea that people of certain ethnic groups are not suited and have to be broken down into the to be part of the socialist project?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, in fact, you could even make an argument, you know, because they arrived in the African continent in the 17th century rather than earlier, that, right, that the kind of a socialist South Africa has these people are still connected to Europe in a way that makes they can never be African, right? You can see kind of a Marxist, Leninist, Stalinist justification for these types of exclusionary policies. And in point of fact, a number of states modeling themselves more or less after the Soviet Union did pursue such policies. So you could look at, for instance, Vietnam's treatment of ethnic Chinese once the relations with the People's Republic of China break down in 1978 and 1979. Or you could look at, you know, the treatment of German minorities in Central and Eastern Europe. In Poland and Czechoslovakia, they're mostly expelled, but there's still some left in Poland. In Romania, they're not, but, you know, a lot of them are internally deported within Romania. A lot are sent to labor camps, particularly in the USSR, but a number in Romania as well. So, and you also have this in Yugoslavia, where they're sent to labor camps and then allowed to leave to Germany and Austria. But you have these certain ethnic groups, certain nationalities that are declared to be counter-revolutionary by dint of their blood and ancestry. And so this starts in the USSR. As I said, the kind of key milestone is when they round up almost all of the ethnic Koreans in the Soviet Far East in 1937, including members of the Communist Party, veterans of the Red Army, anybody who's like ethnically Korean that's east of Lake Baikal, which is like 99% of the population, is rounded up and sent to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, except for those that opt to cross over the border into China. But for those that wanted to remain in the USSR, they were almost all those in the Far East were resettled. And so this happens again during the Second World War on a larger scale because there's more of them with the ethnic Germans in the European part of the USSR.
I actually saw a story this week of an academic in the US, and I can't remember his name. Sorry, you may have seen the story, but he was complaining that he couldn't get a job in the history department. He was excluded from this university because he was a white man, but he was progressive. So he'd been helping the revolution. He'd been helping minorities get these positions in these university departments. And he was, as it were, a true member of the Communist Party. And suddenly he finds himself without a job and no way to earn a living because he's not the right race, not the right ethnicity.
Yeah, David Austin Walsh. And he's late to the party. You know, he's in the 41 deportation. Some of us were already de-kulak guys in 1930.
Yeah, I can see that happening to you here. So why did, in going back to the ethnic Germans in the USSR then, you had the ethnic cleansings during the Second World War, the Soviet Union wins, is victorious over Germany, gets half of German territory. Why did these deportations then continue? I mean, your book goes through into the 50s. Was it purely just that ethnic breakdown? Even though they no longer had a foreign state to have an allegiance to, they were still deported and persecuted.
I mean, okay, so in the Soviet Union itself, right, so they had deported those that they had gotten their hands on in 41, and they were using them for various forms of forced labor, particularly the mobilizations in the labor army for mostly timber and construction in the Urals. And then, of course, punishing the whole group, isolate it, make sure it can't be a threat and can be, as it were, neutralized and integrated into the Soviet economy. So they don't want emigres because emigres are always are a problem. And in fact, a lot of emigres from what becomes the Soviet Union, the ethnic German, were involved with the National Socialist Government. So the most famous one is the Baltic German, and they're socially different. than the Russian German named Alfred Rosenberg, who was head of the Ministry for the East for occupied territories in the Soviet Union. But his number two man almost was a man named Liebrandt, who represented Rosenberg at the Wannsee Conference. He was an ethnic German from Ukraine, a Black Sea German. There's also a man named Carl Stump. And these two are very important historians, both in Germany and the U.S., for the history of ethnic Germans in the Russian Empire after World War II. And so, but they were both involved with the NSDAP. And Rosenberg is the one who convinced Hitler in September 1941. He starts making the appeal on the 15th, and Hitler agrees on the 18th. To stop vacillating about what to do with Jews in Germany, German citizens that were Jewish, and start deporting them to ghettos in the east, mostly Wolsch in Poland. And so the Volga Germans deportation is publicly announced on 28th of August, and the decree is published in German and Russian in local newspapers in the Volga on the 30th of August. On the 3rd of September, the mass deportations begin. So they had been going on for almost 2 weeks when Rosenberg demanded, asked that Hitler deport the Jews in Germany as a specific act of retaliation against the deportation of Volga Germans, which was overseen by Lazar Kaganovich, who was the only Jewish member of the Soviet Politburo left. He had been appointed in 1930. By Stalin. And so there is this kind of connection. And you can see why at the end of the war, the Soviets are so harsh on any escaping Russian Germans. They've had trouble with those that escaped earlier.
Right. And you mentioned then the targeting of Jews in Germany at that particular time then was seen as retaliation for what the Soviets were doing.
The specific first deportation of Jews from Germany that were German citizens had been before the Nuremberg Law to ghettos in Poland was specifically justified as retaliation against the deportation of the Volga Germans. Yes.
You've mentioned the labor army of the USSR a few times. What exactly was the labor army? What did they do?
The concept of labor army was invented by Trotsky, and this was the idea you would conscript, like in a military, mobilize and induct men, although in the case of the ethnic German Soviet Union, it also affected women, for work, industrial work, extractive work, etc. So after the Germans were forcibly deported into Kazakhstan and Siberia, they were completely and totally impoverished, particularly those from Crimea, because they were not allowed to take very much with them when they were moved to the North Caucasus in August, very chaotic forced removal. So these people were very angry, and they couldn't integrate them very well at first, and they were a very hostile reception, particularly in Kazakhstan, by the local Kazakhs, who mostly didn't speak any Russian, certainly didn't speak any German, but the Germans are being housed now in the same houses as them. It's a lot of conflict and fighting. So in order to, one, get rid of the social explosiveness they've now created by dumping all these very angry, impoverished people into these new areas, but also there's a huge shortage of labor because they've had to conscript so many men to fight in the Red Army, they mobilized these people into labor armies. And so then, rather than accuse them of any crimes individually and then have them go through court and be convicted, what they do is they conscript them as if for the Red Army, and they go to the military induction point and they have a physical exam, and then the Red Army, the People's Commissariat of Defense, turns them over to the NKVD, the People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs, or in some cases about 25,000 initially to the People's Commissariat of Transportation under Lazar Kaganovich again, and they are used for forced labor, mostly for felling trees at gulag labor camps in the Urals, but also industrial construction there. And also rail construction, some coal mining, although that's not in the Urals, it's in Karaganda in Kazakhstan and other areas east of the Urals. But basically, they're in the camps of the Gulag, and but there was no charge, no sentence, so they aren't released until after the war, most of them in 48, and the conscription are mostly in 42, so it's about 6 years if they survive it. There are a number that are released early because they are on the verge of death, and some of those people manage to survive, but a lot of them don't. So almost as many people die in the labor army from damage to health in the labor army after being released and die in the labor army itself. So about 60,000 each, about 30,000 each, about 60,000 total. So this is a longstanding Soviet policy regarding Gulag labor camps, the corrective labor camps, ITL, to release prisoners that are almost dead so that they don't die in the camp and make more expenses for burying them and whatnot for the administration.
And your book sort of ends in with a focus, at least for the great years of silence, on 1955. Is it then that the deportations and special settlements and mobilizations all ended simply because there were no ethnic Germans left to deport?
You know, 1955, so in December 1955, 13th of December, the Germans are released from the special settlement restrictions. So they are no longer under the punitive restrictions on their movement, although they can't return to the place they've been deported from. That's in the release decree. And in practice, they can't actually live in the European areas of the USSR. They're confined to the Asian parts. But the surveillance, the requirement that they report to the NKVD every month is removed. The restrictions of not being able to go more than 3 kilometers without special permission from the local special commandant of the NKVD is removed. So they are technically free citizens at that point, although they said there's still some restriction as far as where they can live. And there's still a considerable amount of discrimination, particularly regarding admission to institutions of higher education.
And did all of that continue right up until the end of the Soviet Union, once the Soviet Union collapsed, or were there further developments over the next
decade? Yeah, so there is a movement to try and restore the Volga German ASSR and return there en masse starting in the 1960s, particularly after there's a decree on 29th of August 1964, which lifts the accusations of treason against the ethnic Germans in the Soviet Union. So the Soviet government admits publicly they were not guilty of treason. This was a mistake or a crime by Stalin. This had earlier been announced regarding other groups. The Germans aren't mentioned, but he mentioned the Chechens and the Karachais and the Kalmucks and the Balkars by Khrushchev in his secret speech at the 20th Party Congress in 56. But in 64, they're officially rehabilitated as far as the charge of treason, but they're still not allowed to return to their former homelands or get any restitution for lost property and other, you know, forced labor, etc. So there's this movement, and it fails. It only lasts a couple of years. By 1967, it's pretty much gone out of steam to try and restore the Volga German ASSR. But then in 72, there's a new movement that's much more successful and longer lasting to emigrate out of the USSR and go to West Germany. And the Soviet government lets about 70,000 go during the 1970s, part of its attempt to improve relations with West Germany, particularly during the Brandt government, Chancellor Brandt, attempting to get much better relations with the socialist states in the East, particularly the Soviet Union, East Germany, and Poland. So when the Soviet Union is undergoing reform under Gorbachev, their policy regarding leaving the USSR changes. In 1987, the Soviet government under Gorbachev says anybody who has a state willing to accept them can leave. So most of the diaspora groups had foreign homelands where there was a law for the right of return, including Germany. So huge numbers just started leaving and going to Germany, where they were first called Aussiedler and then later Spät Aussiedler to join the 70,000 or so that had come earlier during the 70s. And there were a number of programs by the German government to integrate them, but basically they were seen as returning home to Germany, right? So you see similar things, the Greeks leaving, Poles leaving, Jews leaving to their titular national states. So over half the German population left. So the 1989 Soviet census, about 2 million Germans in the USSR, and now there's about 400,000 in Russia and 200,000 in Kazakhstan. The rest have largely emigrated to Germany. And so there's something like 3.5 million people that are either from the former Soviet Union, particularly Kazakhstan and Central Asia, which had much greater emigration than Russia proper, or their immediate descendants.
And during the time of these the great years of silence, how many Germans were, I guess, sort of killed during the deportations in being conscripted into the labor army and so on? Was there
you a, want a total of, figure?
Do you have a rough idea?
The total figure I came up with, and there are other people who have lower figures and other people have higher figures. Mine is pretty much in the middle. But what I went through and did the process with my own input variables for the guy who had the lowest estimate. So his estimate was 150,000. I came up with a considerably larger number of deaths at about 245,000. So as I said, about 60,000, maybe 70,000 are deaths in the labor army or after release from the labor army. The reason we don't have exact numbers, we don't know how many died from causes of damage to their health and then died walking foam literally or within a month or so. We do have some numbers. I think it's about 38,000 dying in the labor camps and civilian commissariats of the labor army under the NKVD. We don't have good numbers for those dying in special settlement. They don't seem to start recording them until 1945, and the deportation is in 41. We don't have direct numbers on deaths during the deportation, but there's, if you look at the figures that are in the archival documents, there's some suspicious numbers of people where they have. So it looks like the 35,000, maybe as high as 50,000 dying during the actual deportation. And that would have been around 800,000 deportees. So we're talking around 5%. Dying during the months they spent in the trains going eastward.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Otto Pohl, and about your book, The Years of Great Silence, and the knowledge that you have about, you know, the experiences of ethnic Germans in the Soviet Union. I believe as well that you yourself have been sort of cancelled from academia, as I understand, they're sort of blacklisted from American universities as well, although it's not very hard to be blacklisted from American universities these days. Perhaps before you go, you could share with us, you know, what got you into trouble? Was it researching this, or was it this subject, or was there something?
Well, I mean, a number of things, but probably when my second book came out in 1999, Ethnic Cleansing USSR, it received a very harsh attack by the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum for criticizing Deborah Lipstadt's claim that there was no ethnic targeting of anybody by the Soviet government, that all of Stalin's terror was completely random and arbitrary, and that there was never any singling out of specific ethnic groups for persecution other than Jews. So obviously, having written a whole book on ethnic cleansing. And what made this even more of a piece of chutzpah by Lipstadt was she made that claim in a book about denying the Holocaust, but here she was denying Soviet genocide in the same book. But anyway, Michael Gilb of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum was sent like an attack dog against me. And I'm sure that's where the first ban on me ever getting a job in a U.S. university occurred. It wasn't a big deal then because I didn't have my PhD yet, and I wasn't applying for university jobs, but in 2001, 2 years after that book was published, I went on the advice and support of Brian Williams, a scholar of Crimean Tatars, particularly deportation, but also the earlier history, whom I had given a paper with at Columbia University in 2000. And so, and after I got my PhD from School of Oriental African Studies, University of London, I was kind of in exile in Arizona for a while. But I wrote an article published in 2006, which I was told basically sank any hope of me ever getting a job in the U.S. And that was the article published in Human Rights Review called Socialist Racism, Ethnic Cleansing and Racial Exclusion in the USSR and Israel, which was an article on the Israelis under Ben-Gurion basically copying the Soviet model regarding the Germans and Crimean Tatars as the model for removing the Arab population from the British Mandate of Palestine. So I was unable to get any job in the U.S. I've applied to over 3,000 academic jobs in the U.S. I did get work in Kyrgyzstan for a while, and then for longer, I probably could have stayed, but the money was not very good in Ghana. Other than the money, the job in Ghana might have been the best one I ever had. I had really good students, and I had a really good boss, Kofi Baku, who is now retired. But the money was much greater. I was offered then to a job in Iraq. I was there for 3 years, and then they didn't renew my contract. I'm sure that was also political because I was not on board with the U.S. policy of forcing the Kurds to live in a unified Iraq and forcing all the Muslims in Iraq to become sympathetic and supportive of LGBTQ and radical feminism. I thought perhaps it would be best if we not try and impose our values upon people who have values that are of a different historical origin.
It sounds like, yeah, you have a few conservative opinions that are not allowed under American foreign policy. And some of these subjects you've mentioned actually sound interesting as, you know, maybe you talk about another time. I don't know. But, you know, it sounds like you've had at least an interesting life and done a lot of research in these areas and these places in the world. Something I enjoy exploring, the history of a lot of different patriotic or nationalist movements and around the world and how they fare. You mentioned, I think, Ben-Gurion as well. It's not often gone into the close ties that Israel had with the Soviet Union early on. It's not something I've studied in great detail, but that may be something perhaps we could talk about another time about how the Soviet Union influenced Israel and where they parted ways, because they went in a very different direction. You know, they started off, you know, with sort of more commune-focused policy, the kibbutzes and so on, and went in a very different direction in later decades.
Well, I mean, even after the Soviets and Israelis break regarding state-to-state relations, Israel's economy is largely still on the Soviet socialist model until the 1977 elections, when labor loses to Likud. But this is also a demographic change because labor had an Ashkenazi base and Likud had a Mizrahi base.
Yes, and yeah, the entire subject of Israeli demographics changing and how that impacts their policy at the moment and events that are going on in the world is an interesting subject in and of itself. But unfortunately, we don't have time to go into that today. So perhaps another day. Thank you very much, Otto. It's been great to talk to you and hope the listeners have enjoyed hearing from you. And I'll let you give one last promotion if people want to follow your work somewhere and buy your book. I'll let you plug that one last time to the listeners. Feedback, please send it in inbox@realitycheck.radio.
All right. The Years of Great Silence. And if you're in North America, the place to go is the website for Columbia University Press. They distribute it. If you're in Europe, go directly to the publisher's website, Ibidem Verlag out of Stuttgart, Germany.
And we will be back right after this break.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.